Hello and welcome to Building the Game, a documentary podcast. My name is Rob, and with me as always is Jason.
Holla.
Holla. Whoop, whoop. Whoop, whoop.
That's it. That's all I got. Okay. I'm fine. Done.
Yeah. Okay.
If I could, I would drop this mic on the floor and walk off stage.
Don't drop it. It was expensive.
It was.
You paid for it. You know. And also, it's attached to a pole that is attached to a base, which is weighted and sitting on the floor, so you can't actually... Because we're... Anyway.
This is all true.
Yeah. Uh-huh. How's it going?
It is going.
Just going?
Just going.
Good, bad, neither? Just going? Neither.
It could be stopping, but it's going.
It's going. Nothing stops, man. Life doesn't stop for you, okay?
I'm aware of that.
Guy. I don't know.
Sometimes I question why I'm part of this show.
I do, too. I mean, it was my idea.
It was your idea.
Why did I ever bestow this idea on you?
Because you have no other friends that would do this with you.
That's absolutely correct. That is absolutely correct. All my other friends are boring.
And because I once bestowed a terrible idea on you.
You did that a couple times, actually.
Yeah, but one of those times involved you living like a hobo for 3 days.
Yeah, that's true.
And ever since then, we've been BFFs.
It's all over from there.
This beer is pretty good, actually.
Yeah, no, it's grown on me. I'm not... Well, tell us what it is.
So it's Night Tripper. It's an Imperial Stout made by New Holland Brewing Company, part of their High Gravity series.
Mm-hmm. High Gravity.
Which sounds cool.
It is cool.
This bottle's heavy because of the gravity.
Because there's a lot of gravity involved with that beer in that bottle. I guess.
Yes.
Anyway, it's a pretty dark beer. It's a stout, or is it a porter?
An Imperial Stout.
It's an Imperial Stout. It's quite a bit thicker and heavier than I usually drink, but I'm enjoying it, actually.
Yeah, me too. I mean, I like the stouts, but sometimes they're hit or miss. But pretty much anything by New Holland is good. They, of course, make Dragon's Milk, which is one of the best beers.
One of our favorites.
Ever made.
Ever.
This is 10.8% alcohol. It doesn't feel as intoxicating as Dragon's Milk does from the first sip.
No, I agree with that.
So
yeah,
it's kind of nice, actually.
It's not as making as big of an impact on my brain right now,
which is good.
Yeah,
because you need everything you got.
We got a long night of action-packed recording ahead of us. Hey Jason, what have you been playing lately?
You know, I haven't been playing anything different.
No, mostly.
It's been the normal stuff. Been playing some Dominion. That's kind of been our favorite game,
your go-to standby.
Yeah. Because it's something easy my wife and I can play.
Yeah, sure.
You know, well, another game we played a decent amount of is Forbidden Island.
Yeah,
which for the people who don't notice that don't know what that is. Mm-hmm. That's the game where you're on an island that's sinking into the ground, and you're trying to Indiana Jones it and steal some artifacts.
We talked about that in a lot of detail in one of our first episodes ever.
Yeah. And that's one of the games I got at Barnes & Noble, and we just fell in love with it, you know. And it scales pretty well for four players.
Yeah.
And we're ready to try some tweaking to it.
House ruling.
Yeah, a little house ruling. We like to do that now and then. Makes it kind of fun.
Sure.
So how about you, sir?
Well, I finally got around to trying Nightfall.
Nightfall.
Which,
chain those dots.
Yeah. And we played it with two-player, my wife and I. And the rule book says it's 2-6 or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe it was 2-5.
A lot.
Yeah.
2-5?
I think it's...
Who does that?
I don't remember now. But at any rate, okay. And so, you know, it was our first time playing. We'd never played it before. And so it's that kind of thing where you sit down and you read the rule book. But you don't just... with Nightfall... you know, you unpack the box and you don't just, you know, lay out the decks like with Dominion. You also have to, I mean, you have to sort it all out, but you also have to, like, build starter decks. Because each starter deck is like a set arrangement, a set number of cards of various types. Anyway, and so the process of learning how to set the game up and then, you know, set up those starter decks and unpack the box, and then the next step of actually setting up the game was crazy. Like you start the game, there's a bunch of these mini decks like in Dominion.
Oh yeah. Yep.
Yeah. But each there's a separate deck of draft cards where there's one of each type of card in that draft deck, and then you have to kind of do this thing where each person takes four of those cards and you pick one and pass, and then you pick another one and pass, and then you put two out, and then you put three. It was crazy. We didn't even know what we were doing.
And I didn't get to do that when I demoed it.
Sure, because it would have been all pre-made. Set up for you, yeah. And so, like, for the first hour of us trying to sit down and play the game was just setting everything up and trying to understand what the rules were making us do, and not realizing we weren't even playing the game that we were just setting up. So that was kind of frustrating.
It's like Civilization.
But, I mean, the next time we sit down and play, of course, that'll be 100% obvious to us and will be no big deal at all. You know, it's just that first time was like, what are we even doing? Anyway.
Quite the learning curve to get into it.
Yeah, just that understanding that setup. It seemed like the rule book wasn't saying, hey, don't worry, you're not playing the game yet. You're still setting up. You know, I wish it had said that, you know? There's a section that says unpacking the box. Well, okay, I know that. And then there's the next section that says something like your first game or starting your game or something. But it doesn't say, by the way, you're not playing this game yet.
Also, newsflash.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Okay, so once we got into it, I feel like we did something very, very wrong. Because
that doesn't sound good.
Because as all of our listeners know, my wife always beats me at every game, right?
Yes.
Not always. Just like 97% of the time. Okay.
98.
She didn't... Fair enough. 97.5. She didn't just beat me at this game. She just beat the ever-living crap out of me. Okay? So you've played it. It's been a while, but you played it.
Yeah.
Okay. So you know that you have like these minion cards, and then you have these action cards.
Yes.
Okay. And these minions go out there and they stay in play, and they are used to defend against your opponent's minions attacks, and then you can attack other people, your opponent's minions with them. And when you get through their minions, you then get to attack the actual other player, and you put wound cards in your deck.
Yes.
And once you burn through a certain number of wound cards and the game ends, and whoever has the fewest number of wounds is the winner.
But they also make you powerful.
Depending on what happens when they come up, yeah.
Yeah.
Right, okay. I think she beat me. So the lower the score, the better, right? I think at the end of the game, I had 23 wounds and she had 7. And we were only playing to a cumulative score of 20.
Wow.
So, having only played it through once, I kind of have a hard time explaining what happened because I'm not even sure I know what happened. But you start the game.
Maybe that was the problem, Rob.
Well, but you start the game and you have this deck. I don't know if it's 10 or 12. I think it's what might even be 14. I don't know. Anyway, you have this set of like these one time use minions that go out there, right?
Yeah.
And you start the game by throwing those out there, and then by as you play, you get these action points you can spend to buy new cards to go in your deck. And I feel like by the time I even used like the first half of my starting minions, she'd already done like 15 points of damage to me. Like I never even had a chance to do anything. And having no experience, I don't know if I was doing something wrong, if she was doing something wrong. Maybe we didn't understand something about the rules. We just had a bad set of those mini decks out on the table that were messing us up.
To be clear, it doesn't sound like she was doing anything wrong.
Well, she might have been cheating. At some point, was she missing a rule where she should have been? Maybe she was putting more cards out at a time than she was allowed to.
Did the colors match?
Well, and that's the other thing is that I think at any given time we were only able to chain like two things together.
Oh, there were turns where I would chain like 9 things in a row.
Yeah, no. I think the most I ever chained together was 3, and then she was able to put one thing on top of that.
But you had to be looking at the decks to do that. Like, you had to be paying attention to the colors to do that.
The game was also over in like 6 turns or 6 rounds.
I'm going to say you guys were doing it wrong. Yeah,
but that's what's bothering me.
Because we played like 10 rounds and no one had lost yet.
Yeah, well, and I don't know what we're doing wrong. I'm not sure. And so that was frustrating to me. So, okay, so I tweeted about my frustration with that and my confusion, and I did that. And the one of the guys from the Cardboard Jungle podcast replied back to me and said, oh, yeah, it's not really all that great with 2 people. That in his opinion, it was best with 4 or 5 players.
I think I played with 4. It was 3 or 4 mm-hmm. in my...
And I think that makes sense because at the start, the first thing you do on your turn is you attack your opponent, right?
Right.
And you attack your opponent. And if you're only fighting one, if you're only against one person, then your full force attack goes against that other guy, and you're just going to kill everything he has out there. And if you kill everything he has out there, then on his turn, he doesn't have any minions out there to attack with at the start of his turn. And so you're going to put guys out there, but then when it gets back to your turn, you're going to attack me full on again and kill my minions again. So I would never have a chance to get going. I would never have a chance to get an army of minions out there in play to attack you with. So it basically, the way that worked out, it felt like player two was going to win, period, every time, because of that turn order. So if we were playing with three or four or five players, you'd have to spread out your attacks more evenly, and would give everybody else a chance to be on a more even playing field.
Maybe you should have let your wife go first, like a gentleman.
Well, that's the next thing. Normally when we play a game, I always go first. That's kind of just our default status. I always go first because I'm the one reading the rules.
And because you usually lose anyway, so you might as well get a
bonus.
Right,
it's no big deal, yeah. But that's beside the point. It's just the first turn, you know, first time we play. Because I'm the one reading the rules. I'm the one trying to figure stuff out. And she would rather me figure it out as I go. And then when it gets to her turn, I tell her, okay, now you do that. Now you know, anyway.
Totally makes sense.
Yeah.
My wife would be the same way.
Yeah. So anyway, so I feel like the game could be cool, but then I'm only ever going to understand if it's cool if I can play it with four or five people. Well, four people, I guess.
Right.
So I'm a little discouraged. I will try it again. Maybe this time she can go first. But
you get what you pay for, dude.
Yeah, I know. It's free.
I get it. It was
no. Yeah, it was free. I'm not complaining about it. We'll try it again. We'll definitely try it again. But
what if the damaged box actually damaged the gameplay?
I doubt that happened. Yeah, I don't know. Nightfall was a pretty big release when it came out, and there's tons of expansions for it, you know. And I've heard a lot of people talk about it and talk about how much they like it. And so I'm kind of disappointed with my experience, and that's why I say I feel like I missed something. Maybe two player just isn't the way it's meant to be played. So I just wanted to kind of talk about that.
Right. Well, remember too that I told you that it was way better than I expected.
Yeah.
But I didn't think the game looked fun at all.
Yeah.
So the fact that I actually had a decent time while playing it was a huge lift in my expectations.
Yeah, sure. And you were playing with four, right?
I think three or four. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it just, I mean, it's not my style of game. Kind of like we talked about Smash Up. We've played that a few times. And yeah. I love Smash Up, and it's just not for you. Yeah.
Yeah.
This is kind of like that for me. I love the idea of chaining. I love all that. I don't love the rest of it.
Yeah.
So
anyway.
Especially after playing Dominion, because I feel like Dominion is like, this is the deck building game.
Boy, it's so good. Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Yeah. It's almost as if anything else that wants to do deck building has to step away from the core simplicity and core function of Dominion, because Dominion is so pure, you know, and just works.
And so perfect.
Right. So if anybody else wants to do deck building, they just kind of have to slap some stuff on top of that, and it almost kind of makes it unwieldy.
Yeah, I think that if you're going to try and do a good deck building game, you kind of need to fight against Dominion, purposely make it not like Dominion.
Yeah.
Because if you get compared to Dominion, probably it will lose.
Yeah, frankly, it's true. Right. I mean, there's a reason why Dominion is so successful. But anyway, we should probably move on, huh?
Yeah, let's talk about the mechanic of the week, shall
we? What are we going to... What's our mechanic for this?
Well, so this week, we decided to pick one together.
Yeah, yeah.
And we decided we'd talk this week about currency in games.
Yes, indeed, we did. Currency in games. Money, 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 money.
Boom, boom, ba-dum, boom, boom.
I don't think we can get the rights to that, so stop.
Fair enough.
Yeah. Money in games.
It's a crime.
Yeah.
I love how you just ignore me.
Yeah, I do that a lot.
It's like at home with my wife.
Monopoly. Monopoly is kind of the first game that always pops to my head when I think about money in a game.
Monopoly is all about money.
Right.
You do a lot of stuff, but the only thing that matters in Monopoly, really, is money.
Right.
Because
money ends the game.
Once you're out, you're out.
Yeah, so money in games, but we want to talk about not just money, but currency, you know?
Currency, yes.
Which you could think of that in terms of, like, points to spend, or points to be used in a game to achieve some goal, or to take some kind of action.
Right, I would say let's stay away from resources, because that's resource management. But, no, action points work for that as well.
Sure, yeah.
I think of the game Lawless that I've talked about before.
Yep.
And that game actually has a system where you use gold coins and you use action points.
Mm-hmm.
And the gold coins can be used to buy more action points. So the fundamental game, the purchasing mechanic, is all about action points.
Yeah.
But you can use gold coins to buy additional action points, I think two for one.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, there are obviously lots of games that use a currency mechanic.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not It's not something that's, you know, mm-hmm. not widely used. It's something that's kind of a crossover mechanic. I mean, it's used in both mass market games and also indie games and Euros.
Sure.
I mean, that's not, you know, Dominion has a money mechanic in it.
Yeah, right, right, right. Yeah, you have a limited amount of gold or, well, coins, because there's copper, silver, and gold, but a limited number amount of currency on a turn that you can spend based on what cards you can throw down.
Right, and I like it in a game like Dominion just because it's not a requirement.
Yeah.
You don't have to get a bunch of money. That's a strategy. You can play that way.
Sure.
But with Monopoly, if you're doing good, you've got a lot of money. If you're doing poorly, you don't.
Yeah. Yeah. I just don't, had something in my head.
Rob is currently pondering the meaning of life and also currency in board games.
Oh, okay. But it's, let's think of it in terms of Magic. Because in Magic, that's mana, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And I haven't played Magic since I was in high school. So.
Oh, great. So something you know a lot about. Let's talk.
but mana is something, again, it's a currency you have to spend on that one turn, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
I mean, it's replenished every turn, but yes.
Yeah, right, right.
Tap it to spend it.
Right, exactly. The next game that comes to mind is Small World. Small World, one of the key parts of that game is earning gold, and you can spend that gold to buy other races, or you can just hoard that. Well, at some point, you're going to have to spend that gold to buy other races, but you also want to get as much of it as possible. So here's I guess there's two ways to use money. Or two ways to address money in your game. Money can be the end goal. It can be at the end of the game, whoever has the most money is the winner.
Right.
Or it can be use that money to build up some other stat, to buy other things. Like in Dominion, it's whoever has the most duchies and provinces and estates.
Right, okay? But money gets you those.
Money gets you those, right. Is that kind of the same idea, though?
Well, I like it in games where money has more than one purpose.
Yeah.
I like the idea of a game where money buys you stuff. And in the end of the game, money wins you the game.
Mm-hmm.
I like that idea that there's that crossover, you know, because it puts it on the player to make those decisions then, right? They can't just say, oh, I'm going to spend all my money. Well, they could, I guess. They could say, I'm going to spend all my money to buy more stuff to make me better in this game. But in the end, when they know that the money has to also be what's going to win them the game, it makes for some harder decisions.
Yeah.
I can think of a game that I pitched that has a mechanic like that was the pinball game. It was points, not money, but the idea was you earned points by playing the pinball machine. But whenever you wanted to buy more cards, you had to spend those points.
Yeah.
But the goal of the game was to get to 100,000 points.
Right, right.
So, but you'd never get there that fast if you just used the base cards that you started with.
Sure.
You had to build a better deck. I think Dominion is a decent example of that, even though the money doesn't help you, you know, money isn't a win requirement. I think it's a tie requirement. I think that if you tie in Dominion,
I think you're right.
You then count money.
Most money in there.
But I mean, the chances of the Dominion of actually tying are so slim. You shouldn't even consider that.
Last time we played, I beat my wife by 1 point.
Wow.
Yeah.
But you didn't tie.
We didn't tie. My point is we were close.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm just saying that.
Yeah.
I don't think you should factor into your gameplay style with Dominion. Yeah,
yeah. Sure.
If we tie, I need to make sure I have some more gold so I win. I mean, that's silly.
Yeah.
Plus, I just always get lots of money. That's how I play Dominion.
You know, last time we played, I tried your strategy, just going for money and cards that would allow me to get more money, basically.
Right.
Yeah, and that worked really well for me.
Yeah, I mean, basically, you get cards that feed you more money.
Yeah.
And you buy a lot of money, and then you every time you can buy something that's expensive, you buy yourself a province or a duchy.
Right, right, right. And that worked really well for me.
I've won most of the games with my wife since I've done that. So. Look at that. You're beating your wife. I'm so proud of you.
It finally happened.
Didn't sound right.
Took me a minute to realize why that didn't sound
right.
So, I'm finally beating the crap out of my wife. Wait a minute.
Pretty confident she could take you in a fight, dude.
She has claws, yeah. Well, fingernails, yeah. So she
seems like she'd be feisty. Like,
yeah. So. She's low, too. She's short, so she could get in some little low jabs.
Oh, sometimes the show just degrades.
Oh, man. It goes so far down.
So, money in games, though. So other ways to handle it. I mean, if you take a game like, well, see, that's, I guess that's interesting because I'm not a huge fan of Monopoly, but it actually does meet the criteria of what I just said I like, which is money, you spend it, but in the end, money is what wins you the game. Now,
well, but Monopoly, it's you're never going to get to that tie situation. You're never going to have a, the game is not going to end with two players still in play.
No, but what I mean is you can't spend all your money on upgrades because you have to have cash available on hand to defend yourself, basically, you know, for when you land on their junk. But I guess that is different, though, because I'm thinking, you know, at the end of the game, when a certain something happens, now we count our money and the winner wins.
Mm-hmm.
The winner wins.
The winner is the guy with the most money.
That's what I meant to say in my head.
Yeah.
But instead, I just said, the winner wins.
Yeah. So. Okay. See, let me tell you this, because I've been working in this time we've been doing the show, when I've been thinking of game ideas, I've hit points where I've tried to come up with, or I've hit a point where I say, oh, and this is where you earn money. I've come up with game ideas where you're earning money. And then I've stopped myself and I've said, gosh, you know, if I'm going to be thinking about this from a self-publishing point of view, I want to try and keep my design simple. For example, this tower building game, at one point I was saying you're earning money. Okay. And there's still money involved, but rather than having coins and cards that represent money, I'm doing that as a score tracker, you know,
right.
Which could be handled with currency. But my point is that I pretty much always find myself trying to step away from money, from coins, from tokens, from actual representation of cash in the game. In fact, this tower game is the only thing I've created so far that actually has some kind of a money concept into that, because it's about, you know, building towers, real estate and all that stuff, you know?
Right. Well, I mean,
I kind of don't like money is, I guess, my point.
So
I kind of want to stay away from it.
Well, I just want to point out the game that I sold has money.
I know.
I was thinking about that, 'cause that was actually something we talked a lot about in the design process, was the idea that Gunslinger Ramblers.
Yeah.
The idea is that it has poker chips with it.
Yeah.
Mini poker chips, but still poker chips nonetheless. Some sort of money counter. And that's very important to the game. You have to have
that. Well, because you're playing poker.
Right. But what I'm saying is that was a consideration right up front. We talked about that. I think some on the show, but also off the show, that that's a pricey feature to put into a game.
Yeah.
In Ramblers is a game where you're earning money, and the only thing you can do with money is bet and bank it. And banking is how you win.
Yeah.
But betting is, you know, how you use the cash flow. So it's not like you're out there buying stuff, at least not in its current incarnation.
Yeah.
But it does have some of that in it. But I would agree, is indie game designers, you know, who may be self-publishing some of our stuff, that is a strong consideration of, you know, because how much we talked about this too with the Ramblers, even how many chips are enough.
Yeah.
You know, and you can get the cheap gold coin things. That's what Lawless uses. Citadel,
little plastic discs. Yeah.
And Citadels, if you remember, uses like little wooden tokens.
Yeah.
That look, but they're just gold painted.
Sure.
They're probably a little pricier than the ones in Lawless with the plastic discs. But, you know, those are still, it's still a lot of stuff to add to a game.
Yeah.
Means a slightly bigger box.
More components, more, you know, more box, more money. Yeah.
So I guess this is going from a mechanic discussion more into a pricing discussion.
It is, isn't it? That's not my intention.
But that's okay. I mean, you know, it's something else that has to be thought about for indie game designers.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. Okay, so trying to come back to a mechanic conversation here. So money is, depending on the game, money is... I'm just gonna keep reflecting. Money is money, because I'm trying to figure out what I want to say.
So what's the primary goal of having money in the game? I guess that's probably the question as a mechanic.
That's the question that I want. I'm trying. What is the goal of having money? Is the goal to basically have that be your score, or is the goal to facilitate some other mechanic, or
some other economy, for instance,
sure,
in the game?
Right.
Well, I think most games that use money would use money not as a goal, not as a hoarding goal. Because, again, if you're using money as a hoarding goal, that becomes more expensive to build your game, right? Because
people are going to be, I need more and more and more.
Which is why in Ramblers, you bank your money.
Because
otherwise you would have to have infinite chips.
Right.
So I think if money is solely a mechanic in the game to create some sort of commerce or economy within the game, for one, you can have less, which is cool.
Yeah.
Because people want to spend it. People don't want to hoard it.
Yeah.
They want to get that money out there.
Sure.
So I think that if that's your goal, money is or currency is probably one of the best ways to do that. It kind of divorces it from your actions because an action point system, right? When you have an action point system, which don't get me wrong, I think action point systems are cool because they're so clean.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you've got 10 action points to spend this turn, spend them doing whatever you want to do, including purchasing stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, kind of divorcing those two things isn't a bad thing either because it allows you to focus on here's my money, here's what I'm going to buy stuff with, and then here's what I'm going to do. But maybe I don't feel that way, you know, because it gives the player less options.
It's true.
Or I guess less chance to customize their experience, which I'm big on. I think that in a game, if you can make it a game where people can still kind of customize their gameplay experience,
yeah,
that's a win, right? Because a game shouldn't say you must play this way.
Yeah, you want people to feel like they have control. They have some influence. Yeah.
You know, having one strategy is kind of lame.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, like, I hate to bring it up again, but like Monopoly, right? I mean, people say there are a lot of different strategies in Monopoly, but in my opinion, there's not. You either buy stuff or you don't buy stuff. And
yeah,
in general, most of the time, the person that buys the most stuff has an advantage because therefore they're, you know, most likely for you to land on your stuff and give you money.
Right.
Now, obviously after you finish buying stuff, there's a lot of strategy happening where you determine if you want to put stuff on there and make it harder for them and make the, you know, hotels and houses and all that jazz. But the core strategy is the same.
Yeah.
You know, so I want to play an action point system of Monopoly.
I don't know how you would do that.
Roll and move. I love roll and move.
No, you don't.
I don't. But we're talking about currency today, right, Rob? So I think currency in games is a cool idea, but I think it's a different experience that you're going to get out of the currency.
Yeah.
Rather than if it were, say, an action point system or some other purchasing mechanic to where you could buy one card a turn or a set number. Whereas if you have to spend specific funds on it, your goal is to earn those funds and then spend them on things to get better things.
Yeah.
Because that's, I mean, I don't know why else you'd be spending the money. Hurt your opponent, maybe?
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess for me, I kind of don't like money because I just don't like messing with all that extra stuff when I'm physically playing a game. I like a simple interface with my game. I don't want to mess with it.
Here's a different way to handle money. The Conservator Developer game prototype I made that we played, there was a different way to handle money in that.
Sure.
Because every turn you got money and then you lost money.
Sure, yeah.
So you got X amount of dollars every turn based on what you had in play.
Yeah.
And that's what you got. Mm-hmm. And you couldn't save it. You couldn't store it. You got it. You spent it. You lose it.
Yeah, and that's great because that's money that you count up every turn based on what cards are in play, and that's how Dominion works too. So, you know, based on what cards you can throw down that turn, it tells you how much money you have to spend that time. So I guess what I don't like is I don't like dealing with a bank. I don't like dealing with coins. I guess is what it comes down to for me.
Yeah, I mean, there's something cool about that tactileness of having your pile of money.
Yeah,
but I can also see you strive for such simplicity with a lot of your designs.
I really do, yeah.
You know, and less components. So, yeah, I'm not surprised that you're not a huge fan of money.
Yeah.
You know, having that pile of money there, which is interesting because the tower game you designed is like component crazy.
I know, right? Yeah.
It's like piles of components.
It is. There's a lot of stuff involved with that one, which, yeah, it's very foreign to me. I like a deck of cards that will fit my pocket with nothing. I don't even like dice in my games. I mean, I like dice personally, but anyway.
You know, I actually, just to tangent for a second, I find myself more trying to get away from the dice stuff.
Yeah.
Which is funny because I love dice. I love dice.
Yeah.
Like, I have a pool of dice at home, kind of like Scrooge McDuck has that tower money, and I just swim in it. Yeah. I wear that weird 50s swimsuit that he wore, and then I just swim.
The horizontal stripes, that's like, you know, the legs come down to just above your knees, and you have the, you know, the shoulder straps.
Right. And I just swim around in pools of dice at home.
Right.
But I, you know, ever since we talked in Ramblers, we're planning on pulling the dice out. The dice.
Yeah, you told me that. Yeah.
Ever since we did that, I've been trying to think with other games more like, do I have to have dice in this?
Mm-hmm.
Could I avoid having dice, or could I just have a D20? Or, you know, I more than having like gobs of D6s. Like, can I get around that?
Yeah.
It is kind of an interesting design challenge to do that.
Oh, sure.
To think, can I get around having dice? Is there a better way to do it? Is there a more simplistic way. Mm-hmm. How would Rob do it? That's what I asked myself.
How would Rob do it? How would Rob take all of these extra pieces out? Yeah.
And then I don't do that. Just kidding. So,
yeah. Okay.
Well, I think we
killed that one.
Yeah.
I think we killed that one pretty dead.
Pretty much so.
Yep.
Well, I think it's time for practicing the pitch.
Yes, it is. And, I think our listeners might remember a while back when we announced our contest, and we had our contest winner pitch a game to us. He pitched himself to us. That was the contest idea. He told us who he was and what his goals are as a game designer. And we have the winner of our contest on the line with us right now. We have Chip Beauvais on the line. Hi, Chip.
Hi there. How you doing?
We are fantastic. How are you?
Good, good.
Good. Well, thank you so much.
It's a pleasure to...
Sorry, go ahead.
It's a real pleasure to be here.
We're happy to have you.
So the game that I'm pitching is called Standing in Line. And it's a very short game, and it's designed to be played by two people who are, at that moment, standing in line and looking for something to do. So it's a two-player game. It takes about 2 minutes to learn and maybe about 15 minutes to play a complete game. The components are 36 cards, and I believe you have a copy of the game with you.
Yes, sir. We do.
Yeah, we sure do.
So so I can walk you through a sample turn of the game, if you like.
Yeah, go for it.
Yes.
Okay, so you'll start by, there's a little bit of setup. You'll take all 36 cards, and you'll notice that two of them are double-sided cards in clear plastic sleeves.
Sure, yep.
So you each get half of the deck, including one of the double-sided cards.
Cool.
So in this case, you'll each get 17 regular cards and one double-sided card. And the double-sided card counts as a marker, so it shows you how much of the deck you've gone through.
Okay,
that makes
sense. So you'll each start with 17 cards and with the double-sided card at the bottom. So one of you, Rob, why don't we start with you?
All right.
You'll be the first player. You'll flip over the top card.
Well, real quick.
And reveal it to your opponent.
I only have 15 cards here. I think Jason stole a couple of mine.
I think I did.
Yeah.
There you go.
Okay. So the cards are face down. I'm holding the deck in my hand, and the cards are face down.
That's right.
Okay. So I flip over.
Then you reveal the top card.
Okay. All right. I have 7, Cave Woman.
So the each card depicts a different person that you would see standing in line at a gaming convention.
Ah, okay.
Nice.
And in fact, this particular edition is all taken from people who played the game at Origins this summer.
Okay.
And they liked the game and agreed to be, to be part of the game. So the number indicates how many copies of that card there are in total. Now, during the setup... You each got half of the deck, so you know that there are 7 copies of that card, but there you don't know if the other 6 copies are in your deck or in your opponent's.
Okay.
Now, over the course of the game, you'll learn more about the makeup of your deck and the makeup of your opponent's deck. But to begin with, you don't have any information other than the fact that there are 7 copies of the card altogether. So what you do is you place a bet on how many cards you need to reveal from your deck in order to find another copy of the card that you've revealed. So in this case, if you, for example, if you say 3, that means you think that one of the next 3 cards in your deck is going to be a cave woman.
Okay.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
I get that.
So So go ahead and come up with a number.
All right, I'm going to say 5.
Okay. Now your opponent gets a chance to make his own bet, which is he can either pass, which means that he doesn't think that you can reveal it in 5, or he can bet a lower number to say that it's going to take you fewer cards to find another cavewoman.
Okay.
So, Jason, would you like to either pass or bid a lower number than 5?
I'm going
to
say 4.
4. Uh-oh.
Okay, so this is a once-around bid, so you each only get one opportunity to bid.
Okay,
cool.
So what you're going to do is you're now going to reveal cards from the top of your deck one at a time until you either reveal another cavewoman or until you've revealed 4 cards, because 4 is the lower bet.
Okay. Now, the cavewoman that I turned over initially, am I just going to put that on the bottom of my deck?
Yes. Okay. That's correct.
I'll go ahead and throw her down here, and then I'll turn over 1, which is 4 ladies in waiting. 2 is elf warriors. 3 is ninja assassins. And 4 is another elf warrior.
So I was wrong.
Okay. So whichever player is right gets to score 1 point. Now, in addition to the cards, you also got these little rings.
Yes.
Yes.
And these little stretchy bands, these are how you keep score. Because, again, you're going to be standing in line, so you're not going to have any paper or any way of moving pawns along a track.
Okay.
So the game is played to 8 points, and you have 8 fingers. So you use the ring on your finger to indicate how many points you have.
That makes sense. That's a good way to track that.
Yeah.
Now, something I'm confused about, I bet 4, Rob bet 5. So it wasn't within 4. So is what would happen if it's within 5 or not within 5? Does it matter or no?
No. Once the other player places a bid, the first bid doesn't matter anymore.
Okay.
Okay.
However, the score is going to be the difference between the two bids. So, for example, if you had bid 3, then whoever is right would get 2 points instead of 1.
So, basically, if I bid 3 and it's within 3, I'm going to get 2 points. But if it's not within 3, Rob automatically gets 2 points.
That's correct.
Gotcha.
So, there's some strategy there for bidding. Okay. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Okay. Yeah.
Interesting.
So, that's really the heart of the game.
Mm-hmm.
There's only one other rule, which has to do with when you reach the bottom of your deck, then you shuffle your deck. But before you shuffle your deck, you look through and you choose 2 cards and you put them on the bottom of your opponent's deck.
Okay.
So this gives you a chance to get an idea of what the cards are in your deck and also to modify your deck to... so that you have a better idea. So you're not just basing it on the probability of drawing 1 card out of a random set of 17.
Right. Gotcha. So you kind of get the chance to stack the deck. Mm-hmm. I like that.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Very cool.
So that is, that's basically the game. And as I said, it plays in about 15 minutes.
Yep.
And the other nice thing about it is as you're playing, you're continually keeping score, so that if the game is either interrupted because you get to the end of the line, there's an easy way of determining who the winner is.
Yeah. Right.
Or if you complete the game and you're still standing in line, you could play another round.
Gotcha. I like that. So, and I'm looking at the cards here you sent us, and you have a lot of different characters in it. You have Ebony Knights, Ninja Assassins, Ladies in Waiting, Cave Women, Woman Chasing Pirates.
Yes.
Let's see, what else do we have? Elf. Okay, so Elf Warriors. Did you have any others in there, Jason? Or was that everybody?
I have Ebony Knights. Did you say that?
Yep.
I think that's all.
Yeah, there are 6 different suits.
6 different suits.
I want to give a shout out to Ted Krim. He is the Woman Chasing Pirate.
Right, and Ted.
As I said, we took pictures of all of these people at Origins this summer. And when I was looking over the different types of people I had, I thought, a pirate would be, a nice addition to the set. And I was kind of thinking in my mind what an ideal person would look like.
Yeah.
I'm coming down this huge escalator, and there at the bottom of the escalator is the perfect person that I had imagined. You know, dressed up in a big white puffy shirt, a hat with a big feather in it, as you could tell.
Oh, yeah.
And I, you know, I went right up to him and I said, I've been looking for you. And I taught him the game. And he actually, he liked it so much, he was calling over other people and showing them the game. So it was great.
Yeah. I like this a lot. It's so simple. First of all, the idea of it, there's something to do while you're standing in line. Everybody's had the experience of standing in line, just bored out of their mind. So that is a fantastic idea. I love that it's so simple, because it would kind of have to be because of the situation that you're in. And of course, then it's got to be something you can easily slide in your pocket for when you get to where you're going. You know?
Oh, definitely. And I mean, the game's a little thicker right now, but it's because it's in the sleeves.
Yeah.
In the sleeves. I mean, that would be so portable.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
Just a little deck box, and you could have everything that you needed for the game in there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's great. What kind of what plans do you have?
I've been playtesting this for about six months so far.
Uh-huh.
And I've shown it to a number of publishers. There's one publisher I showed it to actually at Origins, and he really liked the game. Right at Origins, before I left, he said, you know, I'm about 80% confident that I'm going to publish this game.
Oh, wow, that's great.
Unfortunately, other things came up, so that didn't happen. But one of the things that we talked about were different applications of this game. Obviously, the theme is very malleable, so it fit, you know, a lot of different things. I in particular, I like the idea of using people standing in line at a gaming convention as, you know, both the target audience and as the theme.
Sure.
But he also mentioned that, as you mentioned, the rules are simple, so it's a game that could be it could be sort of a mass market game. It doesn't really require a gamer mentality to pick up the rules and to dig into it.
Yeah.
When I was initially playtesting it, one of the first places I playtested it was a Magic pre-release, and it went over really well. And one of the playtesters suggested that theme parks are a place where you've got a lot of people that are standing in line, and you've got, you know, you could use characters from the theme park as the different suits of the cards.
Mm-hmm.
No, that, I think,
so I think that's
idea.
Got a lot of potential.
Yeah, you know, that's the first thing I thought of. Is
me
I,
too.
Last time I was at, went to Disneyland last year with my wife, and, you know, how many lines do you stand in Disneyland every day? And, you know, yeah.
Boy, yeah, I was thinking Cedar Point as well.
Yeah, so easy to custom tailor to those things.
And it's small enough that you fit it in your pocket when you get on the ride.
It'd be an easy pickup in the gift shop, too. You know?
Yeah, oh, definitely.
Oh, gosh. Boy, that's got all kinds of potential.
I mean, they could sell those in the line.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, literally.
Yeah, have a guy walking around with a little, you know, like the old cigarette girl tray hanging over from his neck, you know?
Right.
And just have a set of these card decks and, you know, hey, $5, $8, whatever.
Yeah, and I mean, that's something you could sell relatively cheap.
People would buy the heck out of that.
So.
If you could sell it to them right when they were in line. Boy, that's great.
And they're
this is something with a number of my prototypes, I've taken the approach of making multiple copies of the prototype and trying to sell it to people after they've played the game, mostly to get a sense of how marketable the game is, and to get an idea of how much people would be willing to pay. So I've been selling this game for $12, and, you know, just in the form that you have it now.
Oh, yeah? Okay.
And I've sold at least... I've made about $150 off of it so far. Just going to a couple conventions.
That's great.
And
yeah, you know, if you're committed to continuing that kind of self-publish and that personal sales approach, you might want to consider taking a step up with your, because this is something that really helped Jason and I, taking a step up with the production quality. Because right now, I mean, it's good artwork. It's but like we said, it's piece of paper in a sleeve. One thing that helped us a lot was to take it to digital artwork that we then uploaded to Superior Print on Demand, the website there.
Or GameCrafter. Or whatever.
And you could print a small deck like this for, you know, and have it mailed to you for $8 or something. I mean, it's ridiculously cheap. And the more you order, the cheaper it would get.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so if you're selling it for $12, that could be a real big opportunity. You might be able to sell it
for $15.
Well, right. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. At this point, I'm mostly interested in getting a publisher to pick it up.
Sure. Sure.
But one of the people that I demoed it to is, I think his first name is Dan Yarrington of Game Salute.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
And he was really interested in, you know, in talking about the game and talking about how much it would take to self-publish a game like that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something that I might go back to. But really, my pitch to publishers is exactly what you were saying before.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you printed up 1,000 copies of the game, my ideal situation is you just have a volunteer walk up and down the line, you know, and demo the game to people and say, you know, it looks like you're going to be in this line for another hour or so. how much is it worth to you to, you know, is it worth $10-$12 to, you know, to have some entertainment between here and the end of the line?
Yeah.
And I think that I like the idea that would, you know, go over really well.
Yeah, I think it definitely would, for sure.
That's a great idea.
Yeah.
One of the things I'm working on is I've sent an email to the organizers of PAX, PAX East.
Sure.
And PAX has, PAX's lines are legendary.
Yeah.
In fact, one way to think about it is the lines at PAX are so long that they have their own Twitter handle. In fact, they have more followers than I do. but what I'd like to do is either work with them to create a unique version of the game that has the PAX characters on them.
Yeah.
And then work out a deal with them where they would pay me to produce a certain number of copies, either through a print on demand or through the game crafter, or even working with a publisher, and have the costs covered by the convention. So that then I could just go, I and some volunteers could go and teach people the game and just give it away as part of the, part of the swag that they get for going to the expo.
Oh boy, yeah, that would be a real.
It's not a bad idea.
Great opportunity, yeah. Sure, yeah, yeah. If you could just give it away like that, boy, that would just people would be talking about that all over the world. Because I mean, people from all over the world go to PAX,
right?
Yeah,
and to get free stuff, it's always good, especially free games.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, I like a lot. I
haven't heard back from them yet, but I'm hopeful.
Yeah, yeah, wow. Well, yeah, we wish you the best on that. You know, and I'm sure, Chip, this isn't your only project. Do you have any other big things you're working on?
I do. I have two other games that I'm sort of shopping around to publishers. One of which is called Mission Control, and it's a I'm trying to think of how to best summarize it. It's a map-building game in which you're building a deck of cards, but each deck of cards has one or more planets and paths between planets. So as you play your cards, you're creating a map in front of you, and you score points by being able to traverse the map that you've created.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
I will. I'll give you my URL in, so you can put it up in the show notes.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, that'd be great.
I have what I'm calling a photo journal, which is a series of pictures with an annotated series of pictures which show a group of people actually playing the game. So rather than reading through the rules and trying to figure out how it works, you can see an actual game in progress.
Oh, great.
That's a great idea.
That sounds good.
Yeah, we'll definitely link to that.
Absolutely, yeah. Hey, Chip, we're going to have to wrap up here, but we really want to thank you again for listening to our show and for entering the contest and for sharing your game ideas with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you. This was a lot of fun.
Good. And we'll certainly put a link to your site in the show notes, but just in case somebody doesn't want to go look at the show notes, can you throw out your website?
Sure. It's flyingsheep.com.
There you go.
That's one word.
flyingsheep.com.
And your what was your Twitter handle? It's with Flying Sheep, but I just want to make sure we get it right.
That is an excellent question, and I should know. I believe it's the THE underscore Flying Sheep.
Okay, that sounds right. Yep.
Yeah, that sounds right. We'll make sure we link that in the show notes, too. Okay, the game is called Standing in Line, right?
That's correct.
It looks like a lot of fun.
Looks like a lot of fun.
I'm excited to try it.
Definitely.
So,
Chip Bove, thank you so much for hanging out with us and for talking to us.
Thank you.
All right. I think we should go ahead and move on then to our plugs. And I think first we have a comment here from the website, right?
Yeah, I've got a comment that's targeted at you.
I didn't do it. It's not my fault.
What are you, Bart Simpson now?
I didn't do it.
So I believe he said, I didn't do it. Nobody saw me do it. You can't prove anything.
Okay.
Back when that show was cool 100 years ago.
I thought it was on Krusty, though. When he was on Krusty Clown, he was the I didn't do it kid, right? He would.
Yeah, that is true. Yeah, that was still lame. Okay, sorry to any fans that like Simpsons. This comment is from Brian LeBurge. We like Brian. He gives some great feedback.
He sure does.
It's about your Slenderman game.
My Slenderman game.
And he says,
Go ahead.
This seemed like a really cool game idea, and I hope you decide to retool it rather than drop it. It seems like this could be an easy game to teach and therefore a good quick pickup for games and parties. He said he's curious how you would keep score. His first instinct would be to keep the cards you've played in front of you, and then you could add them up at the end. However, with the cards that steal life, that means that that leans toward having a score track or some piece of paper. He said maybe the cards that give you will points are kept in front of you. Any cards that aren't worth points are discarded. Cards that would normally remove points instead of steal an available card. Since each card has two sides, this doesn't have to be straight up. Maybe if a card is worth 4 points, when it's played in a white round, you steal it and put it on the black side, which is worth less points. And then he ends with, this would be an ability to try to make, this would add the ability to try and make trades with people, since everyone would eventually have public-facing cards. Since some cards are more valuable when they're your character's card, there could be a lot of strategy involved in that.
Those are interesting ideas. My intention with tracking will points was to have a score tracker.
Right.
You know, to have a small board on the table that everybody would have a little marker on.
It's not very simplistic.
Well, it'd be simpler than my original idea was to have little tokens that would be the total number of will points or will gems or something.
Sounds like currency.
Exactly, right.
How about just gold coins, Rob?
This is a perfect example of me trying to step back from that, to move away from that, to say, I don't want all these pieces, all these components. So I decided to step over to a tracker board, right? A point tracker, a will tracker. But if I could do that with the actual cards, I would like that simplicity even that much more.
Well, it makes the game a lot easier to package.
So much easier to package, so much easier just to you know, pick up and put away plus it would kind of be, I like the idea of the more cards you have out there, the more will you have, and it's just kind of this quick visual easy thing to say, holy cow, this guy's got a ton of stuff out there, you know. Yeah, those are great ideas. Yeah, that's definitely worth exploring. And as far as the game idea itself does, I probably won't just simply reskin it as some other monster theme, you know, gothic whatever. But I still really really like the idea. So yeah, I still definitely want to try and pursue that with some other theme or some other approach.
You know. So you're saying you'd actually want to change the rules a little bit to match that other theme?
Yeah.
Rather than just plopping, it's the Grinning Man now.
Yeah, right.
You know, an idea for that would be the Mothman, right? Because we talked about that a little bit. So I'm going to pitch this back to you.
Sure.
So if it was the Mothman, what you could do is, the idea of the Mothman is he shows up before a disaster happens.
Okay.
Right? So maybe you could retool it so that he shows up. And he's predicting a disaster, basically, right?
Okay.
With all the sightings, because that's the idea. That's kind of what the John Keating thing does.
Okay.
In the movie, is in his book. So if that's the case, maybe you have different locations, like just a card that has like a bridge, and you know, because with Point Pleasant, the real Mothman, the big Mothman case, it was a bridge that collapsed and a bunch of people died.
All right.
And they said they saw him on the bridge right before it collapsed. Which I'm sure is true. So
yeah, guaranteed.
So you could actually have like location cards in play, and have some way of playing on those. You know what I mean? Like, you're hedging your bets for what's going to happen disaster wise, like which location is going to have the disaster.
Hmm.
So, or maybe it's all of them one by one, like dominoes, and somehow that's predetermined at the beginning of the game, but you don't know what they are.
Hmm.
Maybe there'd be a way you could have those cards like face down in a row, and there'd be a way you could peek at certain cards. So you'd be like, okay, the third thing is the bridge. All right. I know the third thing is the bridge. So, yeah. Anyways, just some food for thought.
All right.
You don't have to like it. I really don't care. So, sure. So that's the comments we had. Now it's time for plugs.
Yeah.
I'm going to quick start. Yeah. I just want to give another shout out to our Unpub friends.
Yes, please do.
For Unpub 3 coming up in January. Go to unpub.net and check it out. Strongly encourage you. Those are good guys and doing good stuff. Your turn.
Okay, yeah, and I just wanted to hit up a quick podcast that I'm a fan of. It's called Super Ego. Super Ego. It's a comedy podcast by some these guys are professional comedians, Paul F. Tompkins, and he's the only name that comes to mind. Patton Oswalt's on there a lot of times. It's just this kind of weird mix of sketch comedy and scripted comedy and improv, and they do a bunch of little scenes. They'll come up with a scenario. And then these guys will just have a bunch of comedians in their studio, and then they'll just kind of make up weird conversations and weird characters. And it's all audio. So it's sort of like a comedy radio play that can get kind of vulgar sometimes, but it's really funny. They do some really good Star Wars parodies sometimes, and, it's a lot of fun. Find it on iTunes, Super Ego, check it out. It's really, really funny.
Excellent. You actually played a little bit for me with some Star Wars stuff, and it was pretty funny.
It's good, yeah. I mean, some of it's bad, some of it's kind of nonsensical. Like I said, because a lot of it's improvised.
Right.
So sometimes you're just kind of not sure what's going on, but when it hits, it hits more than it misses, and when it's hit, it's great.
Yeah.
It's great.
Sounded like it.
Yeah. Okay. I think that's it for us tonight.
I think so, too.
Okay. We wanted to thank Chip Beauvais again for hanging out with us tonight. Thank you very much, Chip, and we look forward to hearing more about your projects in the future. And thank you to everybody for listening to Building the Game. If you want to check us out in more detail, you can... sorry, you can't really check us out because you're not going to see our pictures anywhere.
Except for on Twitter. Oh, no, we're... we're goofy avatars.
We have cartoon pictures, yeah.
I'm going to post a picture of us on Facebook.
Don't do that. They'll be so disappointed.
I'll just Photoshop in cooler looking people.
Mm-hmm. Just Photoshop our cartoon heads over our real bodies.
So basically that picture's already out there.
If you want to check out our website, that's buildingthegamepodcast.com, or you can send us an email to buildingthegamepodcast@gmail.com. You can follow us on Twitter @podcastbtg. Jason is @JASlingerland. I am @poorly_designed. You can give us a 5-star review on iTunes if you'd like to. I mean, we'd really like that. You know,
we'd love it.
We would love that. You can also like us on Facebook, and if we can get to 100 likes, Jason has an extra special gift to give out to the entire world.
And now maybe a picture too.
And now maybe a picture. You can see our ugly, ugly, ugly faces. And did I miss anything?
I think you covered it.
All right. Thanks again, everybody. Good night.
Good night.
Building the Game is a co-production of Imminent Entertainment and Poorly Designed Studios.
All the ideas presented by Rob and Jason are the property of the Building the Game podcast.
Next time on Building the Game.
What are you trying to understand?
What purpose does money serve? Don't do that. It's gross. You know, you might have noticed that I'm very careful to remember which one of these is mine and which one of these is yours, because I know you rub your freaking beard all over it. All over that freaking pop screen.